This is Smeagol. When I'm not trying to protect my precious from wicked, tricksy hobbitses, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. They talk about many things that you filthy fanboys will love to listen to. And while you're listening, make sure you follow them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and any social media on which you can find them. What is Twitter? Is it a bird? Is it tasty? Can I eat it? I can't eat Twitter. Smeagol is so sad. Smeagol wants to eat Twitter. Well, if I can't eat Twitter, I'll go listen to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. It will make Smeagol happy again. Happy, happy, happy! Just make sure you don't touch my precious while I'm listening.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm here doing part. I'm here doing part-time. I'm here doing part. I'm here doing part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, this finally worked.
I guess so. Welcome to Skype technology.
Yeah. You know.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Well, I think what's also wonderful is that we are eventually doing this after talking about it for what, like
2 years, 18, I think.
I was going to say 18 months, but you might be right. It's probably 2 years.
Could be 18 months, 2 years. I don't know. Time flies. Yeah. It's everywhere on my end of the world. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate you finally being able to make the time.
Oh, I think it was just a question of, for whatever reason, like the schedules or...
Yeah.
Definitely not on purpose.
I was like, Charlie hates me. He never wants to come on my podcast. Well, you know, I realize you don't need me. I mean, you're funding Kickstarters left and right.
Well, I will say I have been very fortunate on Kickstarter.
Yes.
I don't know. And I try to, where I can, share that love with other people, because I know it's a fickle platform.
Okay.
And, you know, my combination of something seems to be working on there.
Sure.
I'm going to ride that as long as I can and try to keep doing good things for people.
Sure.
I this campaign in particular has been absolutely insane.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we should let people know who you are first. Do you want to introduce yourself, or you want me to do the honors?
If you have something written, you can go for it, or I can give you something off the cuff.
Never have anything written. I'll just say your name. Your name is Charlie Stickney, correct?
Yes.
And you are the creator, sole creator, co-creator? How are you build on White Ash?
On White Ash, I'm a co-creator with Connor. I think if you develop a comic book, now I had a script before I went to find Connor.
Okay.
But as we worked together, for me, it felt more like a partnership.
Sure.
And that was something I wanted to evolve into with him. And I think, you know, this is just the kind of, I think, like, if you're a writer out there looking to work with an artist and you're not an established writer,
yeah,
holding on to being the creator of the comic can sometimes get in your own way.
Sure.
Because, you know, I mean, the artists, they want to be part of something that's great.
Yeah.
But if it's part of somebody else's thing that's great, it's less interesting to them. And then if it's their thing that's great too.
Sure, sure, sure.
And you know, if you have the right collaborator, you realize you can make something better together than you know, you ever would on your own. So, you know, so yeah, we are co-creators of the White Ash comic book series. I also I've done another comic book with Connor Hughes, who's the artist on White Ash and my co-creator on that, called The Game.
Yes.
But before that, I have worked in animation and feature film and independent film and many other aspects of a lot of different things, where I've been a professional writer. And I think all that experience really helped me when it came to Kickstarter and to self-publishing, because I had worked in trailer cutting. I had worked in pitch building for, you know, pitching animation series. And I think when you're trying to make a Kickstarter that's just going to speak to people, it's not just about your comic. I mean, there's so much more to it than that. And so I've been very fortunate that I had a lot of different experiences in the past and things that I've worked on that all I've been able to bring specifically to Kickstarter to sort of help things take off there.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, we should also say that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast, and my lowly self is Christian Horn, and we should say right off, I mean, we've mentioned Kickstarter a couple of times, but the reason that we have you on this show is because you've just started a new Kickstarter for the latest issue of your series, White Ash. And like I said, it seems like you don't need any publicity, but I'm happy to have you on because God knows, you know, any project, just throw more money at it, correct?
Well, yeah, I think it's great, but yes.
Just keep throwing money.
I would say, like, yeah, please, like, if people want to throw money. But I also like to, you know, I'm a bit of a Kickstarter evangelist.
Uh-huh.
So I like to get out and talk about that process. But,
sure.
You know, one of the things that Kickstarter enabled me to do was also to land a distribution deal with Scout Comics. Mm. So there's, you know, I think one of the reasons why this campaign is doing well, and it is, you know, for anyone who's listening to this, this went live on March 9th, and the Kickstarter will be going until April 8th.
Yeah.
We are also right now in comic book shops with White Ash. And so Scout's doing their version of White Ash right now. And we're working on kickstarting future issues of White Ash.
Sure.
And what I wanted to do with Kickstarter and sort of my philosophy with self-publishing in general was, you know, it's a very different market on Kickstarter than it is in comic book shops, and there's different expectations.
Sure.
So I wanted to try to find a way to create a product that would do really well on Kickstarter, but then I could also make available to comic book shops as something completely, you know, that would feel unique to
sure.
the comic book shop experience as well. And so to that end, I was looking at different places trying to find the right publishing partner who would put it into comic book shops. I briefly looked at self-publishing myself and putting it into comic book shops, but that's such a difficult thing to build an infrastructure. You know, and like having now gone through this process, I realize how valuable the branding of just an established publisher is.
Okay.
So, you know, just when you're trying to reach out to the stores to be able to say, hey, I've got a comic book in Diamond, is great.
Yeah.
And then to be able to say, and it's coming out through Scout Comics, and then they say, oh, we love Scout Comics, tell us about it. Versus if I was just calling them and saying, hey, I've got a comic book shop, would you like to carry it in your stores? More often than not, they're going to say no.
Sure.
Or we'll take three on consignment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's like that was really helpful for me. But, you know, going back to my philosophy, I wanted to create something that could do well for Kickstarter people, but also create something that I could put into comic book shops. And I also wanted to preserve the digital market for the publisher as well. So when we were doing our Kickstarters, I never put the book on Comixology
or yeah.
tried to put it into comic book shops. You know, just sort of saying, the market I've got is Kickstarter.
Sure.
And I'm carving out all the others for whoever I make a publishing deal with. And then, you know, what we've been doing on Kickstarter, and I'm looking to probably continue this, is we kickstart larger issues, you know, which helps because then you can ask for more money on Kickstarter.
Uh-huh.
And you deliver something more substantial to backers who are waiting 2 to 3 months for a book. It's not a 22-page book. I think the shortest book we've done is a 32-page book on Kickstarter, but most of them have been 40 or 52 pages long,
sure,
you know, which is almost 2 to 2.5 comics.
Yeah.
However, then when we go to try to put it in comic book shops, you know, that's not a format that works well for a publisher publishing on a monthly schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to put out 22 to 26 page floppies. So we have been, you know, so I take like a 40-page book and I turn it into 2 22-page books.
Sure.
And if you do the math there, you know, it doesn't quite add up. So we're doing new pages for the Scout version to make the 40 book into 2 22-page stories. And so, you know, it's 4 new pages of content and it helps me break the story up a little bit differently. And add new cliffhangers, new, you know, splash pages here and there. So it becomes a different beast for the comic book shops and something brand new that they can sort of say is their own version. And then, you know, it gives, you know, people who've backed the Kickstarter something else.
Sure.
That they feel comfortable picking up because they know it's got a new cover. It's kind of a new experience. It might be a little bit more collectible in some ways because it's from a mainstream publisher. So, you know, so that's kind of what I've been doing from a business model perspective.
Sure.
And now that we've launched this Kickstarter, I mean, it's done so well over the first couple of days. I think what's also happened is some people who've been buying the Scout comic have come back to the Kickstarter because they like the book so much. So I think both markets are feeding the other.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to claim ignorance because I've never really heard of Scout Comics as a company before. How did you come across them, or how did they come across you?
So Scout is a relatively new company. They've been around, I think, 5 years at this point.
Okay.
And their market share is rapidly increasing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had offers from several different publishers, and Kevin Joseph, who does a book called Tart that's okay. on Kickstarter and some other books, he's out of Florida, and he knew, like, and Scout's out of Florida, and he was sharing, you know, he had been talking about maybe doing Tart with them, and he showed them White Ash, and they immediately contacted me and said, we'd love to do this with you.
Sure.
And I said, and why do I want to do it with you? I mean, not in that way, but
yeah, sure.
Like, you know, we had a lot of back and forth, and I realized here was a publisher that was going to give me a place and let me publish the comic the way I wanted to do it. You know, like, everyone looks at a place like Image and feels like if you're an independent creator, that's the goal of the place you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like White Ash would be like a perfect fit at Image, because one of the things, and sorry to interrupt, that I noticed immediately, and I think, immediately about White Ash when I discovered it, was how professional it looked, like how seriously, you know, top notch the artwork, the story, like everything was. So to me, it's like that sort of like top of the indie heap. And, you know, for better, for worse, or whatever, you know, whatever anyone thinks, when I think indie and I think kind of top of the heap, I think like Dark Horse, I think Image, I think that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was definitely a thought at one point. I went through, you know, I spend a lot of time researching how comic books are doing on the market.
Sure.
In terms of the numbers the books are putting out, to try to figure out what kind of revenue could be coming back through that stream.
Sure.
And I, you know, Image has probably the best deal for creators out there. And if you don't, you know, if people don't, you know, who are listening to this don't know the deal with Image, basically what they do is they take a publishing fee. And, you know, that's changed over the years. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it might be around $5,000. And then, you know, they take that fee, their costs are covered. And after that, it's pretty much going back to you. And they don't take any IP sales, percentage of the IP. So it's just they are publishing your book. They're taking a fee for publishing your book. Once their costs are covered, you get money.
Gotcha.
And if your book does really well, you make a lot of money with Image.
Sure.
But so, you know, looking at that model, the problem is if you look at the numbers of issues that, that comic book companies are selling now.
Yeah.
There was a title that Image was putting out called Crowded. I don't know if you know Crowded.
It sounds familiar, but.
But it was nominated for an Eisner last year. Unfortunately, like the single issue sales are now under 3,000 per issue.
Jeez.
You know, and that's through Image. And they aren't going to be able to sustain the model any longer where they're doing monthly sales. Because for Image, it's not making enough money.
Yeah.
Because like if you do the math on that, you know, it's say 3,000 copies. If it's a $4 book,
yeah.
At most, that's, you know, $12,000 that's being sold of revenue. But then out of that $12,000 of revenue, you know, 6,000 of that is going to Diamond and to the comic book shop. So that leaves $6,000 worth of revenue that's split between Image and the creators, and their printing costs are probably going to be, you know, $2,000 or $3,000. So, you know, that book's in the hole.
Yeah.
Image, right. You know, so like, I think, you know, Image needs to have numbers of somewhere around 5,000 to, you know, to break even.
For wow.
Image, you know, like, and so the creator's not getting anything at 5,000. The creator is getting something at like 7,000 or 8,000 copies. So like, you know, again, my numbers could be a little off, but roughly, you know, if you're selling 8,000 issue, you know, 8,000 copies of an issue, figure, you know, as the creator, you know, you might be able to make 6,000. So 8,000 copies sold, you might be able to make 6 to at most 10,000 per issue. And depending on what your page rates are that you're paying to an artist, you know, 10,000 doesn't go very far.
Yeah.
Or, you know, more likely, it's probably more likely 6,000 to 8,000 for that 10,000 for that. Because, like, again, the print run gets more expensive and all of that. So the numbers really aren't adding up unless you are, you know, you can sustain making a comic and paying a decent page rate at Image if you're probably doing 9,000 to 10,000 per book.
Yeah.
Okay. And now if you look at how many books, say, Image is selling that are above that, it might be 10 a month.
Yeah.
And all those people are big name people.
Sure.
So, you know, even if they had picked up White Ash, and I'm not going to say that, you know, that they would have, I mean, I think the book definitely is the kind of quality that would fit on the shelf with a lot of their titles. You know, we would have probably made a decent amount of money on the first issue. We would have made some money on the second issue. By the third or fourth issue, I would be in the hole every single issue to produce the book.
Sure.
And, you know, like that's just not a sustainable model. So, you know, so what for me made sense was if I could afford, if I could raise enough money on Kickstarter to, keep making the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I found a publishing partner who would put it out, and would keep putting it out as long as I kept making it.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, like for me, that was the most important thing, because I scripted out a rather large story for White Ash. I mean, everyone says when you're starting, you start these 4-issue arcs or.
Sure.
I ignored that. I mean, White Ash is conservatively about 60 issues.
Holy cow.
And there's plenty that
have. You're like been, Robert Kirkman with The Walking Dead.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's, I go
or Preacher.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, so for me, I wanted to find a place that I could publish the book that I could keep, you know, once I started the story, that people would get to read the whole story.
Sure.
And a place that would be okay, you know, because of me being smart about the numbers, would be okay with me continuing to kickstart.
Yeah.
You know, and so like all of a sudden I was looking at a different set of publishers that were going to be more flexible to that model.
Yeah.
And then like I met the guys with Scout and I talked to them, and I was talking to them on the phone, and they had all these amazing ideas about where the company was going to go. And I realized that not only was it a company that I liked the people, that there was room for me to, you know, help them grow mm-hmm. together, where mm. I, you know, it's like going back to, you know, what I said initially about as a writer, you want to feel ownership in something.
Sure.
You know, this was a company that I could help grow and I could feel ownership of.
Sure.
You know, like that there's a place for me there beyond just being a creator. You know, like there's some things that I could do to help the company. And then it seemed to me that that made a lot of sense as a fit. And then I got to meet James Hake, and I got to meet Jim Pruitt, and I was like, oh, these guys are great. Mm. And so like it just really became I also met Don Hanfield, who's a partner in the company, who's out of Los Angeles, and he's also a TV producer. So, you know, like they had a lot of things, a synergy that worked with me. And I just really liked everyone at the company. And I said, this feels like the right place. And it's been the right place. And Scout's doing some really cool stuff. If you look on Bleeding Cool, they just, they launched this vending machine initiative. I don't know if you saw any of those.
I think I've heard of this. Yeah. Like vending machines with comics in them.
Well, it looks like a vending machine. It's
gotcha.
Actually a display.
Okay.
But it looks like a vending machine, and, you know, it gets people's attention.
Sure.
And we're rolling them out into a bunch of comic book shops, especially in the Los Angeles area to start with. Mm. So, you know, there's going to be one in Heidi Ho. There's already one in Pulp Fiction Comics in Culver City. There's going to be one in Golden Apple.
Nice.
You know, like there's a program for the retailers, I think, where they're setting up some consignment sales too, just to help get the word out. So like there's less risk and
oh, cool.
a lot of visibility for Scout. But yeah, like it looked, and everyone's like, oh my God, if you put your quarter in, is my comic going to be damaged? Cause they look that good, but they're really just, like, you know, like, you know, just these amazing displays. So like they're doing a lot of stuff like that to kind of shake up the market. And they have some really good ideas for digital comics that I won't get into. And they just launched a couple of different, you know, imprints. They now have a YA imprint. They have a kids imprint. They have a horror imprint. And I'm also now helping out editing a couple of titles over there too.
Oh, wow. So, that's great.
Yeah. So like, for all those reasons, it's been a great fit, and I'm loving working with them. And you know, who knows? You know, you never know with anything how it's going to play out. But so far, it's the right choice.
That's really cool. I mean, I kind of want to go back a little bit though to the sort of question of comic shops, because I mean, you mentioned like comic book sales and stuff like that, and I love comic shops too, but. You know, and you mentioned sort of Bleeding Cool, and it seems like every other day, like Bleeding Cool or another comic news outlet is sort of reporting on a comic shop closing or something like that. Or I was in London back in November, and there's actually a comic shop in London that's going to stop selling floppies, or maybe
right,
has already. Yeah, just to trade and stuff like that. Or, you know, paperbacks or manga or stuff like that. And I actually went to that shop, and it was, I forget what the name of the shop was. I'm such an idiot, but I actually left some bookmarks for my little web comic there. They were very nice. And it sucks that I can't remember their name. But in any case, you know, so there's this sort of thing that seems to be happening with comics and comic shops. And as you mentioned before, you again, you keep reading stories about like creators making their own indie comics and not making money. So, or being, you know, in the red or making like 50 cents per copy or whatever it is, like these really sad, sad stories. And I've actually had creators on this podcast as well who have been like, I poured 20,000, 30,000 into my indie, you know what I mean? And so to me, the question to you is, what do you need the comic shops for at this point? Like, could you have taken your sort of hardcover that you did and gone to a bookseller, you know, like Scholastic or something like that? Or, you know, to not necessarily avoid the comic shops altogether, but I mean, you seem to be doing really successful on Kickstarter. And again, I'm not trying to insult the comic shops because I love them and I love going in them and I love buying the stuff. And, but I am a person who's drifted away, you know, from floppies and stuff like that. So what is your sort of reasoning for, you know, signing up with Scout and being like, let's do floppies, like that sort of thing?
Well, so I think there's a couple of answers to that. I think you have to think about, you know, what your goal is with your comic.
Yeah.
You know, and the type of comic that you're doing may play differently to different audiences. And, you know, if you're looking to do a 4-issue miniseries, and like this is going back, like, if White Ash had just been a 4-issue miniseries or a 6-issue miniseries,
yeah,
that's the kind of thing that actually could do really well at Image, because the attrition of sales over the subsequent issues would be fine because your first issue would sell so well, you could pay for the rest of the series.
Sure.
So like, you know, I just want to put that caveat in. If you're doing a miniseries, it's a different sustainability model than if you're trying to do an ongoing series.
Yeah.
So, but if you're trying to do an ongoing series, I think as a writer who's doing independent comics, you also have to, you know, you think about what's your end goal. Mm. And, you know, I've worked in, you know, in feature film. And so I understand a lot about IP development, which is intellectual property, which is, you know, like all the comics that are being turned into film and TV shows. So, for me as a writer right now, one of the things I'm doing is when I write something, I'm writing it as both a film and a comic, or as a TV show and a comic, or a comic and a TV show. I think it's really important that if you're doing a comic, you're not just doing a comic to try to sell it as a TV show.
Sure.
Or taking a TV script and just turning it into a comic, because
because that seems to be everybody that I interview, like everybody that I interview was like, I used to have a script or this was going to be a TV show and I made it into a comic. And you're sort of like, I've interviewed David Popose, who I know, you know, and he's kind of said the same thing that you're saying, which is like, I wanted to make a comic, you know what I mean? Which kind of blows my mind, because it seems like the general zeitgeist out there is like, hey, everybody make a comic so you can make it into a movie, you know?
Well, okay. So again, like what I'm saying is, like, if you're going to translate your script into a comic, you have to, you know, the end goal has to be to make a great comic.
Yeah.
And not make something that you can sell as a movie.
Sure.
You know, like, and I think that's the big distinction, because they are two very different forms.
Sure.
And even though there's a lot of overlap, if, you know, like, there's a way to do that quick and cheap if you just want to turn it into, you know, turn it into a comic. Mm. You know, like, you can find people overseas who will do the art for you very cheaply. You know, I'm like, and that's going back to, you know, like me investing in Connor. I wanted to work with someone who I knew I could make a great comic with.
Yeah.
Because as someone who's had a lot of shows, you know, not happen or, you know, die in development or be in development for a long time, I know how easy it is for something to never happen with, you know, with your product, your script. So for me, I wanted to take a shot to make a great version of, you know, of White Ash. Mm. And, you know, if down the road we're going to turn it into a TV show, you know, like, that's wonderful. But, you know, like, I also have this incredible version of it, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I think that's, like, it's, are you trying to get enough issues so you can just turn around and sell it?
Yeah.
Or are you trying to make a great comic? Like, that's for me where the distinction is. But, you know, and stomping all over that, one of the reasons why I, you know, honestly went with the floppy route is because having a comic book shop in comic book stores with a publisher still has more cachet, a lot more cachet than self-publishing.
Sure.
So, you know, and you know, like you, like, as you said before, you hadn't really heard of Scout Comics or maybe ever heard of Scout Comics. But me doing crazy numbers on Kickstarter means almost nothing to, you know, a producer. Me being published and put into comic book shops where they can walk in and see it means a lot more.
That's so crazy. I mean, I understand like the reasoning behind that, like that they can go in and to like a physical copy. But the thing is like you're burning it up like on Kickstarter, like almost from the beginning, right? And
yeah.
Those are metrics, like people online, like those are numbers that people who, you know, and you know, people who are investing in your comic. And like the thing about Kickstarter to me that tends to be fascinating is that people will put more money into an issue of a comic than what they would pay in the store, right? So like, because a lot of like comics you see on Kickstarter sometimes, you know, I end up buying digital copies a lot because like, it's like the first issue of a floppy ends up being like $15. And, you know, and as a parent, like I know you are as well, there's a part of me that's like, guys, like I can't, I've also got enough floppies to last me a lifetime. I have so much stuff that I still need to read. So I tend to buy the digital issues. Now with White Ash, it's such a quality product that I'm like, no, I'm just going to, I'll pay whatever. Like, you know, that's how much I am impressed with your book and how beautiful it looks. And, you know, but to me, that says even, that's like even more impressive and should mean more to like a producer or somebody who's interested in developing a product. Am I making sense?
Oh yeah, no, totally. I mean, like it was something that was kind of eye opening to me because I've been around Kickstarter long enough to know how hard it is, what I've been able to do.
Sure.
You know, and like the kind of numbers that I'm able to generate off a floppy that's not selling, you know, 15 different naked covers.
Yeah.
Because like that's also a different model unto itself.
Sure.
It's tough. I mean, I think the pricing structure on Kickstarter is a little bit different, you know, and if people are listening to this who haven't been on Kickstarter, I mean, part of the reason why is that you have to look at those as like artisan comics.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like these are self-published books where the costs are so astronomically high.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, just to give people some, you know, numbers, I did close to 13,000 on my very first Kickstarter. I did close to 15,000 on my second, and then I was like 24,000 on my third Kickstarter.
Wow.
You know, like off single issues. That said, I was kind of breaking even after three Kickstarters.
Oh, wow.
You know, like so like it's expensive to produce these things yourself because you don't have the infrastructure and price breaks of being able to mass produce things.
Sure.
So, you know, every time you're getting the rewards or the shipping, like I've spent probably close to $20,000 in shipping over the last couple of years.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, like so at this point, I think, you know, my overall number is over 150,000 that I've raised on Kickstarter. I think it's just about that.
Do you know how much that translates into how many books you've sold?
It's hard because like sometimes there's overlap. I mean, so but my point is like there's not that much of that money was profit.
Sure, sure, and, understandable.
And so you know, my goal is to get a big enough fan base where I can keep bringing those costs down lower.
Okay,
you know, which will then in turn expand the fan base because there'll be more people coming to it and going, oh. You know, that's, you know, you're charging $8 now for a 40-page issue.
Yeah.
That's a great deal. You know, like, okay, there's some shipping. Okay, fine. If I could do that, I would love to do that. So,
sure.
But if I was to say hit 1,500 backers for a campaign, I could probably do that.
Yeah.
So that said, like, I was shocked when I first went into, because I, again, from my TV and film side, I have an agent, and I, you know, go to places like, Universal Picture Company and, you know, talk to people, and they like the book, they like the idea, and they're like, what's next? And getting that from other places, and it's like, so this seems like a really cool thing, and you have these things that you can give us, but when's something going to happen with it? And that something is code for, is there, you know, it's the same way that, and I hope this isn't too much insider baseball. Like,
no.
If you have an agent, the agent can send out your scripts, and the studios will now read your scripts because there's an agent saying it's good enough.
Sure. That,
you know, the agent is the person who's the arbitrator, who's going through and saying, okay, this person is good enough, and the studio trusts their taste, so they read it.
Yeah.
And so you just need to have very, and then to get an agent, you have to have people kind of recommending you, so they'll do your read, you know, they'll read your stuff. But it's like, it all comes down to that thing of like, what's the stamp of validation of quality from someone else? So I'm not going to lose my job taking a risk on this thing, right?
Yeah.
And so the deck is stacked against you as an independent creator trying to go out there and say, hey, you know, I have this thing that, yeah, you know, a thousand people come and back it, you know, and that's really good. And they're like, well, it's only 1,000 people. You know, we're hoping for an audience of, you know, 20 million, but they don't realize that, you know, 800 people or 1,000 people, what that represents and how hard it is to secure that audience and how that would extrapolate forward if you were doing the same thing at another place.
Yeah.
So, so it's just like, there's not the same level of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, like, a lot of people who are in these development positions, they now know about comic books because they got into a development position.
Sure.
And they were told comics are hot. So now they're trying to learn something about comics. And where do they go to learn about comics? They go to the comic book shop.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a cycle. And especially here in Los Angeles, you know, a lot of the stuff that gets picked up is from people walking into comic book shops in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So, like, that, you know, like, if you are a comic book creator who is listening to this outside of Los Angeles, and you're looking to self-publish, the biggest piece of advice I would say to you is contact the comic book shops in Los Angeles and see if you can get them to put it on the shelves if you want this to maybe be turned into something.
Sure.
That's my very long-winded answer of saying why I wanted it to go into comic book shops.
Sure.
Now, the other part of this answer is, depending on who your publisher is and what the deal is, they are going to take some of those intellectual property rights.
Yes.
And the bigger the company, the bigger the chunk they're going to think they deserve.
Sure.
So, you know, if you're with Scholastic, which is about, you know, like, I wouldn't be with Scholastic because, you know, we're not the right age range.
Sure. That was just an example. Yeah.
You know, so, but if you were with them, they would say to you, this is the deal you're going to take.
Yeah.
And you say yes. Because like, those, you know, those books will generate you a fairly decent, you know, number of royalties, even if it doesn't do well. Not doing well for Scholastic is a lot better than doing really well at some other places.
Sure.
Other places. So, because of that, they can say, okay, we own 30%, 40%, 50%, 60% of, you know, whatever subsequent rights happen to the project. So,
sure.
You know, again, if you are a creator who's not in Los Angeles, who doesn't have any connections, publishers who offer deals like that are more appealing. Because 50% of something is way better than 100% of nothing.
Yeah, for sure.
I think people need to understand that when they talk about bad deals that publishers give them, because there's a reason why publishers can do that is because they actually have access. They, you know, they are the gatekeepers. They are the people that the studios are going to look at. And it's a harsh reality, but it's, you know, something that I can speak to from experience. Again, even with, you know, having a manager and walking into Amblin, walking into Bad Robot, you know, like these are companies that I have, you know, met at before with developed people and talked about projects. And, you know, that's, you know, having a publisher that puts comic books in comic book stores means something.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good to know. I mean, that's interesting because, you know, I mean, the sort of thing that you sort of keep hearing is that they're suffering or they're struggling, although they seem to be popping up everywhere in LA. Maybe that's why, because they're sort of like a IP workshops, you know. But yeah, I mean, you do keep hearing stories of like comic shops kind of either folding or limiting what they're going to sell. So, I mean, that's a good justification for sure.
I also think, you know, it's not just comic book shops, it's bookstores, right?
Sure.
Because like so much of that product went online and there's digital sales and there's all kinds of reasons, you know, for all of us as consumers, if it's just a product and it's not food that we want fresh and it's not clothes that we need to try on to go get it online cheaper when we don't have to leave our houses, right?
Sure.
I think the comic book shops that are thriving are the ones that have gone to the model of building community.
Okay. Right?
You know, comic book shops, like, because like comic book stores in general serve a specific community. So there's something that's built in for them to, you know, to gravitate to. Mm. So like, you know, the ones that have weekly game nights where you're going to see your friends. There's this incredible shop in upstate New York called Pulp 716. I think that's the name of the comic book shop, and they're doing amazing promotions with comic book creators. Like a Canopus, which just came out from Scout. It's this great story about this woman who wakes up with amnesia on a planet in a spacesuit and doesn't know how she got there and why she's in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And then the whole mini series is about her kind of reclaiming pieces and trying to, you know, uncover that mystery of who she is and remembering bits from her childhood and tracking up to the point where she is now.
Wow.
And it's great. But if you go on Twitter, they had someone cosplaying as the woman in that outfit.
Oh, wow.
And the photos are incredible. And leading up to the release of the book, for like 2 weeks, they were posting these pictures in their Twitter feed.
Mm.
You know, so they're working with comic creators to promote the comics, which then gets the comic creators to promote the store. Their store, they have two shops, and they're also coffee shops. And they have a very female-friendly clientele. And like all their employees, most of the employees, at least in one of the shop, from all the photos I've seen, seem to be women who are working there.
Hmm.
And, you know, like on all the women, you know, they have to read at least one comic on their shift. Knowledgeable.
Sure.
But it feels like, you know, and you see all these pictures of the game nights and the date nights and the things that they're having there and the events at the store. And it just looks like this great place to be.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, Heidi Ho here in Los Angeles does a lot of, I know they have magic card nights.
Yeah.
The Comic Bug does a lot of, you know, they have a comic book creator group that meets there. They do a lot of signings. You know, so I think that's one of the things that the LA comic book shops, Atomic Basement, which is a new comic, they're having all kinds of events with the community. So if you're a comic book shop and you're just trying to reach out to the people who have a pull list, who only get Marvel and DC and maybe Walking Dead or one or two other titles, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Most likely, because that is a group that's growing smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't, like there are comic book shops that don't want to have Dog Man in their store.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't, I mean, I, I assume you know Dog Man.
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, Dog Man is the kids' book, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It's like that.
I blanked out for a second, but I was like, oh, no, I know this because my daughter was kind of into it for a while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, all the kids want it. And, you know, like, it's gateway comics.
Sure.
Know? And if they're coming into the store to pick up Dog Man or Captain Underpants or Diary of a Wimpy Kid,
yeah,
you know, like all that stuff, you know, then they'll gravitate to other comics as they get a little bit older. And so, you know, a lot of shops now have a YA/kids section.
Yeah.
And honestly, these are the biggest selling graphic novels in the country.
Yeah.
They sell bonkers numbers. So
Scholastic. Yeah.
Like they're insane. I mean, just like 10 million copies or whatever, like these, they're printing money.
Yeah.
So if you're a comic book shop, like there's a lot of comic book shops, or there have been a lot of comic book shops that feel like, you know, their clientele wouldn't like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they're not open. They don't have a kids section in the store. They don't, you know, like they don't want to devote shelf space to that. And I think those are the kind of stores that will have trouble over the long haul versus the ones that are actively trying to build an all ages community and, you know, be something that's more than a place that you go to buy books.
It's
a place that you go to hang out, that you have coffee, that you talk comics, that you, and those are the stores that are really thriving.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about, the Kickstarter and all that stuff and the development and things and why to get it into and Scout Comics. But, you know, I realize we haven't even talked about like, what is White Ash? Like, what is it about? Because we're going on the assumption that everybody knows what that is. And we want them to go to your Kickstarter and throw much more money at it than you've already raised. What is White Ash?
Well, White Ash, I like to say it's Romeo and Juliet meets Lord of the Rings in rural Pennsylvania.
Nice.
Which, you know, it's not actually Romeo and Juliet, but it's a genre mash of fantasy, horror, a little bit of forbidden romance, because, you know, when you have characters and you have love, it makes things a little bit more interesting. Set, you know, that's grounded, that's set in, you know, a real place. I like to also call it, say, fantasy creep, where, you know, it feels like the real world, and then you realize just around the edges, things are a little bit different. And then as the series goes on, you realize how different they are. My other quick pitch is if the guys from Supernatural got stuck in Riverdale, but rather than having to battle demons from hell, they had to deal with the worst from Mordor.
Nice.
So, you know, like that's what it is. It's you know, like for me, the kind of stories that kind of speak to me are tales about our world to make it more interesting. I love high fantasy that's just set in, you know, the world of dragons or the, you know, the world of elves, whatever it is. But for me, you know, growing up, I always wanted more, you know, from life. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, especially people who read comics. You're doing it to escape. So for me, you know, it's kind of that halfway story where it could really be here, you know? And so White Ash is this world set in this mining town in rural Pennsylvania, a coal mining town. That's not just a coal mining town. And I will leave that for people to, you know, if they go to the website, if they go to, you know, the Kickstarter, there's plenty of non-spoilery bits that you can read. Including there's a 24-page preview of the comic. There's some videos. But if you want the secrets, you know, some of the secrets spoiled, you can, you know, read further on in the page and you'll get more of the juicy bits. But there's a lot of juicy bits left to go. So I have, you know, when I started working with Connor, so he would know how to draw some of the facial expressions, I gave him a 12-page, you know, single space document called The Secrets of White Ash. Just so he would know, you know, where some of these characters were going, what they were hiding, you know, what all the skeletons in their closets were, who they really were, things like that.
That's great. I mean, it's really funny because just to talk about the book again without spoiling anything, I remember the way I discovered it was I think you might have placed an ad like in an Alterna press book.
Yes.
Not sure. And it was like, here, check out this free comic. And it was a beautiful, I think it may have been the cover of the first issue. It was Connor's artwork. And first of all, I have to say, like, I cannot rave about this guy's work enough. Like, it is fantastic, like gorgeous. Like, I love, like, it is one of the big reasons where I'm like, yes, I love the fantasy elements and all that wonderful stuff, but this guy's work is solid. He's amazing. I want him to be on White Ash forever, but like, he is up there with, you know, the big guys at Marvel and DC. Like, that's how great I think he is.
He is really next level.
Yeah.
I was incredibly lucky to find him.
How did you find him?
Well, so when I started doing this, I placed an ad on several places on the internet. And shockingly, when you're offering money to artists as opposed to exposure,
sure,
you get a lot of replies.
Oh, so you were offering a page rate too?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, I was
plus creator, like sort of like that sort of incentive as well.
Well, I was offering some back end originally, and then, you know, as sure, we got working together more, our deal kind of modified.
Sure.
But yeah, like I was offering a decent page rate, and as I found out later on, you know, more than some other publishers were paying, and I've continued to, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, like we pay real rates in White Ash.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that's important too. Like if you can afford it, you should, because, you know, the artist is what it's going to make your book live or die.
Sure.
But, I got about 200 replies to my ad. And then
wow,
it was about sifting through to find the right group.
Yeah.
And fortunately, one of my oldest and dearest friends is an animation director.
Oh, okay.
And so he and I sifted through, and then he saw Connor's pages and he's like, who is this guy?
Uh-huh.
He's like, where does he work? And I was like, I don't know. And like, and he's like, I don't care. He's like, he is the one that you want. I mean, he's just night and day better than, you know, all these other people.
Sure.
And Connor had a really interesting story where he was at the School of Visual Arts in New York, with, David, Mazzucchelli was one of his teachers.
Oh, wow.
And, he was, you know, he was really good. And, but he also had like that, you know, East Coast Puritan work ethic, and
sure,
he got in his head that he shouldn't have, like, he shouldn't be doing comics because it's a little bit too frivolous and flighty, and so he had to get a real full-time job. So he went from there to becoming one of like the two or three in-house graphic designers at the UN.
Oh wow.
In New York. So, you know, like doing this other high-end art job.
Sure.
And so he was doing that for a while, and then his wife got a job teaching high school art, I think, or maybe it was middle school art. And so she had a steady income, and he's like, you know what, maybe it's my time to take my shot. So he entered the first Mark Millar talent search.
Oh, really?
And he was one of the winners of that.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, I think it's so important to try to find a good colorist to pair with, you know, your artist.
Sure.
And, you know, we're really fortunate that Finn complements kind of really well.
Yeah.
But the person that they paired him with in the book did everything, you know, to undo kind of what makes Connor great.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, it I had seen his samples that he had sent me, which were black and white. But had I seen those samples that had come through that, I probably wouldn't have given him a second thought.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's just it she did the line holds on the wrong things. It just, like, again, I think this was another young colorist, and maybe she's gone on to do great things. And so, I don't want to say anything bad, but it just wasn't a good fit.
Yeah.
And so, like, he kind of just, that was it. And then he saw my ad and replied to it.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, kind of like an unknown, and but a classically trained comic book artist. Like, he went to school to draw comics.
Sure.
And what he understands more than anything else is storytelling. You know,
yeah.
I think that's, you know, people forget that when they're looking for a comic book artist. But I specifically said in my ad, you know, if all you can do is the angry, sexy face, or, you know, the sexy, angry face, you know, that's not what you're looking for.
Yeah. And
Connor was looking for the chance to draw something that wasn't just superheroes.
Sure.
He wanted real people.
Yeah.
And so it was just a great mix of the two of us getting together. And he is like, where he started to, I mean, like, was great, but where he's at now is just incredible.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, sort of going back to my original point about your book is I remember getting that first digital issue, and I think I may have contacted you like right after reading that, like to get an interview back then. And I think you were going to like San Diego Comic Con or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But in any case, I remember reading the first issue and reading it and being like, huh, okay, this is interesting, sort of slice of life, blah, blah, blah. And it takes a while. And then it sort of like creeps up on you, like what's happening. And I remember being like, I like this, because at first I was like, I think this is just sort of like, in my mind, it was sort of like a Hardy Boy sort of thing. Like I was like, okay, like there's a mystery and something's going on. And then by the end of the book, I was like, oh, this is more Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, you know what I mean? Like, or like you said, Supernatural or something like that. And that's sort of very much what I appreciated about the first issue, you know, on top of the art. And I was like, I didn't see what came coming. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. No, this is, it's been interesting for me. I wanted to pace something a little bit different than you see in a lot of comic books.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kickstarter.
Kind of risky.
It is, but Kickstarter gave me the ability to do that.
Sure.
Right. You know, 'cause I wasn't doing a 22 page issue. Like our first issue that we did on Kickstarter was 52 pages.
Yeah.
So it was more like I knew where there was a hook in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to end the first issue on that hook.
Sure.
And I could have gotten there quicker, but I really wanted to, you know, set the tone for the town.
Sure. Sure.
And yeah, like I think, it is a little bit of a slow burn, but we're in a binge age now. And so people catching up on the series, you know, I think it really works for them.
Yeah.
You know, the series that I've done, the follow-up one that I'm working on right now, also parallel to this called The Game, I'm pacing that a little bit quicker.
Yeah.
But still.
Which is also excellent, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. I have my own pace for writing.
Sure.
And I think I like a lot of comics that are made today, but I think some of them feel too thin. And
sure.
I think they have a lot of, you know, good one-liners here and there, but
sure,
they don't pace them the way that I like my story paced.
Sure. Sure. No, totally, totally understandable. I have one sort of final question for you, because,
sure,
you know, we've been on the line for an hour and
yes,
you've got kids and I've got a kid and all that wonderful stuff. So you want to do 60 issues. What about the, and, you know, Scout Comics is obviously putting something on the shelf, I would imagine, or wants to put something on the shelf regularly. Can you talk about the schedule with which you're doing Kickstarters? Because we're talking about like a Kickstarter. How many months go in between Kickstarters?
Well, so yeah, like that's, it's a difficult question. In the end, it comes down to the pencil speed of the artist you work with.
Yes, of course.
Because, you know, like if you're a writer, you can just crank out an issue every couple of weeks if,
sure,
if need be.
Don't insult writers, Charlie.
Right. Well,
it's, I mean, not like, that easy. No, I'm just kidding. I know, like, what you mean.
Yeah, but like it just depends on also the length.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Like I think once you have the story, it should, you know, like TV writing, they give you like 3 to 4 days to write the entire episode.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Like the, after the writer's room beats out all the plots and bits, you have 3 or 4 days to go home and write it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Maybe a week.
Wow.
So so there's a different pace that you're expected to write at, but also, you know, it's your full-time job, right?
Sure.
You know, you're going in there and you're doing 8 to 10 hours a day on it because you're getting paid the money to do it.
Sure.
But, you know, So going back to, you know, your question, what we're doing right now is Scout is doing 6 monthly issues. It's going to finish the first arc. Mm. They'll then do a trade a couple of months later.
I see.
Then there's going to be a one shot that's going to come out towards the end of this year. That's a spotlight book on a character from White Ash.
Okay.
That's going to be mostly just brand new material just for Scout.
Yeah.
And then next year, we'll start the next arc of White Ash with Scout. And then I have a White Ash spinoff miniseries that is also going to be coming to Kickstarter later this year. So my hope is what we would do is we would do another arc of White Ash next year. Then this miniseries spinoff would happen, which I'm working on with another artist. You know, just because Connor can't do everything.
Of course, yeah.
And then...
But it's jarring sometimes for fans, you know.
Yeah, well, this... But it's not... Let's just... This is not set in White Ash.
Okay.
With any of the active characters.
Sure, okay.
So it works being a slightly different art style.
Sure.
Yes. So like for that, so it would be a spin-off series that could be a 6-issue series, which could then fill the other 6 months of the year.
Sure.
And then hopefully we could roll back into White Ash. And then I have another mini-series spin-off slated that might come out the following year. So, you know, ideally what would be happening is White Ash fans who are just following the Scout comic would get 6 issues every 14 months or so. But they would also get maybe another 5 issues of more White Ash history and bits of the story through these other miniseries.
Wow. That's ambitious.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, like I came on and said, go big or go home. I do not do this small. You know, like these are stories that are mapped out to add important information. It's like I said, look, you know, Marvel wants to do their interconnected universe. I'll just do my own.
Sure, sure. As all comic creators should. I think you should strive for that. That's great. That's great. Well, Charlie, I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time to finally come on to Part-Time Fanboy with me.
I hope I made it worth your while.
No, you did. It's great when I run into you at conventions. It was great seeing you at the LA Comic-Con last time where I finally got the hardcover.
We will have conventions again to run into each other with.
Hopefully. I mean, as of this evening when we record, Disneyland shut down, so or is about to.
Yeah.
So the apocalypse is upon us. Hopefully not. But you know, even if it is upon you, make sure that you go to Kickstarter and look up White Ash, because I'm not gonna lie, I think this is like probably one of the greatest Kickstarter books out there, like that I've come across. Like anytime I've gotten a package in the mail from you guys, the package has been, not only has the comic been fantastic, but everything that's come along with the comic is fantastic. All the extras, all the little knickknacks, all the wonderful doodads that you guys slip in there once, you know, you cross a funding goal. So I think people should just, you know, be throwing money at you guys.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, it comes from the heart, because I mean, I like comics, but it's really great when you come across something as special as this. And I think it's fantastic. And I'm actually honored to have you on my podcast, because, like when I saw it the first time, I was like, I gotta talk to this guy. I gotta talk to these people. So in any case, your name is Charlie Stickney. Where can people find you online other than the Kickstarter?
I'm at Charles Stickney on Twitter, at Charles Stickney, because Charlie was taken. And gotcha. I just didn't want to fight people for it.
Sure.
And there is actually whiteashcomic.com, which right now reroutes to the Kickstarter.
Okay.
There's also a White Ash Instagram page. I think it's White Ash Comic. But Twitter is basically the place to find me.
Okay, great. And right now it's Kickstarter. It's White Ash. And this is Part-Time Fanboy, and my name is Christian Horn. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode, as long as the apocalypse holds off. All right, bye now.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Oh yeah, doing part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.